It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Jav, I just heard on Counterspin that things aren't looking so good for all of you over at the Seattle Weekly.
Yeah, we had a merger this week with the New Times, which is a very conservative libertarian sort of outfit out of Phoenix, as people just heard on Counterspin. And a lot of people at the Times or at the Weekly are very worried about this. And in particular, they're worried about my position there, which they should be. I've been at the Weekly for 8 years through four ownership changes now, and so far they've left me alone. They've left the absentee ownership has pretty much left the Weekly alone locally to do what it does, and does very well. It's a very profitable paper right now. So if New Times is smart, they'll leave us alone. But that is not their MO. That's not their history. There was an interesting article in the Washington Post this week in which Michael Lacey, the executive editor of New Times, was quoted saying the following: "We know damn well that good stories sell, not people doing raving opinion pieces about how outraged they are. Blogs have made it completely unnecessary to have alternative newspapers fulfilling that role." Between the fact that they don't like progressives, they don't like freelancers, and they don't like columnists, I'm probably in trouble there. So if people value my role at the Weekly and you know, so far as I'm aware, I'm really the only person in town, general audience media, who's been allowed over the last decade to do this sort of thing, advance progressive politics consistently, that I may be asking people to let the Weekly know that they value my presence there. Alternatively, if people have any job leads, I might be interested in that too. So so people should be aware, you know, it might work out fine. They might leave us alone. They might actually give us resources to do more investigative journalism. But that's not the concern right now.
All right. Well, I've got some holes in the ceiling at home that I could use some help with. So
I got some tools. That's good.
Although I'll have to comp you for the work. So, all right. Well, moving along, we are just a little over a week away from a big election coming up.
Yeah, we historically on this show do endorsements. We have an election coming up on November 8th, and so what we wanted to do this week was talk about the initiatives and the ballot measures, and then we'll talk about the elected offices next week. This is something we do in Eat the State every election, and that's up on the web now for people who want to check it. www.eatthestate.org. And there are some instances, including one we'll get to shortly, in which Maria and I disagree, and we'll talk about those too. We don't have a cross-the-board editorial stance at Eat the State. We have a lot of people with differing opinions, which is good. You know, you get a chance to air that. But these are opinions. The usual caveat expresses, you know, do your own homework, make up your own mind.
Have your own opinion.
Check out, you know, multiple sources for information about these candidates, about these ballot measures. But this is, you know, our take on things. So we might as well get going here, just going through them rapidly. We'll start out with the City of Seattle Advisory Measure Number 1. Now, this is an advisory measure that asks the following, and I have the quote here if I can read it. It asks to advise the mayor and city council that every person in the U.S. should have an equal right to quality health care and that Congress should implement that right. Now, this is a wonderful sentiment. It's also a complete waste of time. Number one, city council isn't in that business. Number two, Republican-controlled Congress isn't about to listen to a bunch of Democrats from Seattle saying that every person in the U.S. should have quality health care. On the other hand, voting no on this kind of sends the wrong message that the people shouldn't have quality health care. So
vote yes.
Yeah, vote yes. It's kind of an unfortunate thing. I really don't know what the purpose of this measure is, but you might as well vote yes on it. Kent County Proposition Number 1 is the Veterans and Human Services Levy. And again, this is a mixed bag. You know, I don't know why we're funding veterans at the county level. This should be a federal responsibility. But the human services portion of this levy is desperately needed for homeless services, for housing, for shelters, and so forth. So vote yes on that as well. We then come to the two monorail propositions. And this is a point where Maria and I have diverging views. She feels yes, I feel no. And I don't know if we want to reprise these arguments or not. We've certainly had them on the air before.
Yeah.
You want to go ahead?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's really the only major transportation solution for West Seattle. And the fact that the monorail board recognized that, instead of saying, let's build the line from Ballard to downtown, they said, let's build a line from West Seattle to an area north of downtown, which will still serve some residents of Magnolia and Queen Anne. I think it's a good, I think it's actually in pretty good shape right now. I think people should vote for it. And also, I want to remind folks that if the gas tax is implemented this year, about 90 to 95% of that money is going to go to building roadways. And we want to be asking ourselves, do we want to be getting into this frenzy of building roads and building roads and building roads and having them fill up and having more gridlock, et cetera, or do we want to at the same time also be investing in some transit as well that takes people out of traffic, and that's what the monorail does. You should also note, too, that nobody is talking about any other kinds of transportation alternatives for West Seattle, and West Seattle commuters sit in gridlock that is worse than just about any other neighborhood in the city. So,
you know, and that's very fair. I think it's really unfortunate that the monorail has come to this. It's a good idea. It's certainly needed. It's also, unfortunately, I think, something that a municipality cannot afford to build on its own, and there's simply no federal funding available for this. There hasn't been federal funding available in the past. The congressional district delegation has said that it's impossible to expect, and that's even without factoring in that the city council and the mayor are now opposed to the project. Which is, you know, certainly a black mark in the eyes of the federal government. I simply don't think we can afford it, no matter how necessary it is. And I also think the gas tax is likely to be repealed, which is another unfortunate development that we'll talk about in a minute.
Yeah, we'll probably disagree on that as well.
Oh, okay.
Because I don't think it's going to necessarily be repealed, but
well, that's what all the polls show.
Really? Well, let's wait till we get to that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I've pretty much had my say on the monorail. I think it's a good idea. I just don't think it's affordable, and I don't trust the monorail board. I think they've had a demonstrated record of incompetence over the last 3 years, and it's still the same people in place. So
there's two propositions for that.
Yeah, the first.
Yeah, that's the first proposition. The second proposition deals with the monorail board, and there are 9 people on the board, 2 of whom are currently elected, and this would expand it to make it 5 people currently elected. And regardless of what happens with the monorail, whether it goes up or down, I think it's a good idea to have the monorail board elected.
And we agree on that one.
Yeah.
That the more people you have elected on the monorail board, the better.
Yeah, the more accountability, the more responsiveness of the public. So vote yes on that.
Okay.
So moving along, we have the statewide initiatives. I-900 is Tim Eyman's latest initiative. This has to do with performance audits. And somewhat remarkably, I think Eyman has come up with a good idea here. This would give about $17 million worth of sales tax money each year to the state auditor's office to enable them to perform audits at this performance audits at the state, county, or local level, and gives them pretty wide latitude in doing that. That's a question of not only auditing in terms of whether money is spent spent ethically, but whether it's spent wisely, effectively. And I think that's a long overdue measure. So I would say vote yes on that.
Yeah, and I agree.
Okay, great. We have I-901, which is the indoor smoking ban, and I'm going to part ways with probably a lot of our listeners here. I think this is a bad idea, particularly the 25-foot rule. An indoor smoking ban is long overdue in the state of Washington. Unfortunately, this one also extends to outdoors to the point where it's really unenforceable. It bans smoking within 25 feet of a doorway, window, or vent, which basically means all public places except the middle of the street. I think they need to come back with an indoor smoking ban that doesn't have that provision. So I would say vote no.
So this is another one where Jav and I part ways. I do recognize that it's not easily enforceable. Also recognize, too, that it doesn't involve any money for helping people quit smoking, which is probably one of the most addictive things that we have
going
in
our
society.
That would be a good measure.
Yeah, and it would be good if we saw some of those tobacco settlement funds spent on something else besides balancing the state budget and actually going into smoking cessation programs, but we're not seeing a whole lot of that. On the other hand, I'm one of these people who has a real hard time with secondhand smoke. It triggers migraine headaches for me, And I recognize that there are also millions of other people out there who have a problem with secondhand smoke. I also don't enjoy having to wade through a lot of secondhand smoke to get in and out of buildings, stores, even the building where I go to do my, twice weekly exercise class. I have to walk through a chain of smokers to get in to do something that should be healthy for me. So I can see where people would vote for this, and I think I probably will personally vote for it for that reason.
Yeah, and I can understand that also. I also find it annoying. I don't think that something that's annoying should require a law. We have enough laws already.
Annoying, but also particularly bad for your health. Secondhand smoking can be as bad as actually smoking yourself. Plus, smokers tend to compare secondhand smoke isn't as bad as, say, standing next at a bus stop inhaling car exhaust. Well, that's not true. Secondhand smoking, as studies have shown, secondhand smoke can be worse for you, approximately 50 times worse for you than inhaling car exhaust.
Well, so I'm not in the habit of inhaling car exhaust, so yeah. I won't go with that.
And they're not counting biodiesel, though.
So people are not even really aware of how bad a carcinogen cigarette smoke really is.
Yeah, and there's a lot of carcinogens in cigarette smoke that have nothing to do with tobacco that are actually added there by the tobacco companies.
It's
pretty lethal stuff.
Its addictiveness. So.
Yeah. I-912, this is the gas tax repeal measure. I'm afraid that it's likely to pass. I would urge people to vote no on it. I think it's a reflexive anti-tax measure. The gas tax initiative that the legislature passed is not perfect. It's very heavily on roads and needs to have more in transit. But it breaks political gridlock in a way that hasn't happened in the past and is not likely to happen for years into the future if this passes. So I would say vote no. 912.
I'm not going to argue against that. Although, just to point out, there are some people I've heard in the progressive community who are going to vote for I-912 because there isn't enough money there for transit. On the other hand, I would urge them to vote no on I-912 and to vote for the monorail to fund both, because we can. I disagree with Job. I think we can afford both of them.
All right. What else?
We have I-330, which is the AMA's anti-malpractice suit initiatives. This is very much a special interest initiative that is designed to protect doctors as well as anyone else who's remotely connected in professional capacity with healthcare from being sued. You will not be able to file lawsuits against these people if I-330 passes. I would say definitely vote no on that one.
Yeah, and the supporters of these malpractice initiatives have cited, this so-called epidemic of malpractice suits in the state of Washington.
It's simply not true.
In fact, that's not the case. There is, Washington State does not have an epidemic of malpractice suits, and so it's really a non-issue.
Yeah. On the other hand, we have I-336, which is sort of a competing initiative, and this one would do several things to combat the alleged scourge of malpractice lawsuits. One of the better ones, though, is that it would enact a three strikes law against doctors who seriously injure or kill their patients. If it happens three times, the doctors can no longer practice, and I think that's an excellent idea. So this is why doctors are opposed to it. And if you read the voters' pamphlet statement, really about the only thing they can say against this initiative is that it was initiated by trial lawyers, which is the sort of a red herring argument that you get when somebody's ox is being gore, but they can't fess up as to why they don't like it. So I would say vote yes on this one.
Yeah.
So that's I-336. And then the only one we have left is Senate Joint Resolution number 8207. And this is a simple housekeeping measure that has to do with district judges and municipal court judges being allowed to serve on the Commission for Judicial Conduct. And for the life of me, I don't know why voters have to approve this, but they do, so I would say vote yes.
And I don't have an opinion on it.
Oh, my.
So that's all up on the web at www.eatthestate.org, and we'll talk about the elective offices next week.
Okay. All right, let's jump over to National. And
a lot happened this week.
Yeah, that's right.
Boy, let's start with Scooter Libby. Skedaddle.
Yeah,
this
week, Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor or the investigator in the federal grand jury investigation against the Bush administration for having leaked the name of Joseph Wilson's wife. She was an undercover CIA agent. He printed an article in, I believe it was the New York Times,
yeah,
saying that he had been sent on a trip to Niger to check out whether Iraq had purchased any yellowcake uranium from Niger, and he'd found that there was no evidence of it, and that in fact the documents were probably forgery. The documents that showed that was the case were probably a forgery. And he came back and said that, look, here, this key piece of evidence on which the Bush administration based their decision to invade Iraq was simply not true, and that the Bush administration knew that, and they went ahead with the invasion anyway. Days after he printed that article, the identity of his wife, Valerie Plame, a CIA agent, was leaked to the press in an article written by Robert Novak, in order to discredit Joseph Wilson. Now, and they said that Valerie Plame had arranged to have her husband go and check out these, et cetera, kind of setting up the Bush administration as the good guys and the CIA and Valerie Plame and Joseph Wilson as the bad guys. Now, that brought up this question of, okay, who in the White House leaked her identity, and that is a crime. That's what the grand jury's been investigating for the last 2 years. And Scooter Libby, the chief of staff for Dick Cheney, he has been caught in
whopper.
In a lie. Yeah.
Several whoppers, actually.
Saying that he had heard Valerie Plame, had gotten the name Valerie Plame and heard about her identity from reporters that he had talked to, when in fact the reporters who were interviewed by Fitzgerald said the opposite, that they had gotten the information from Libby, and they were all very consistent in their testimony. And in addition, we have heard now that there are notes suggesting that Libby heard this information also from his boss, Dick Cheney, and that Libby had discussed with Karl Rove, George Bush's senior political advisor, had discussed with Karl Rove before leaking Valerie Plame's name, had discussed who their journalistic contacts were. So there's some evidence that this could go higher. Libby was the easy guy to indict. They had evidence that he had lied to the grand jury. And so that's what they're getting him on. They're not getting him on the crime of having leaked the name. But that means that there's also, once they've indicted Libby, that means that they're also going to be looking higher. That means they can get a whole bunch more evidence. It'll go into a criminal trial. There'll be a further investigation. And I'm sure they're hoping they can smoke out whoever ordered Libby to talk to the press about Valerie Plame.
Yeah, we still don't know a lot of things in this case. We don't know who was giving Libby orders to leak the smear campaign, whether that extends to Cheney, whether it extends to Bush. We don't know who forged the original Niger documents. There were some revelations in the Rome Daily La Repubblica this week that suggest that trail goes back to the CIA and the White House as well, and that the forgery was then slipped into the intelligence stream in Italy. Those things are all subject to continuing investigation. There's a sort of a tantalizing hint in Fitzgerald's indictment about an official A, who is probably Karl Rove, who was Robert Novak's source. We don't know who Novak's actual sources were for his column right now.
Yeah, he did testify. However, he has not talked about it at all.
No.
Under advisement from his lawyer.
And why this man is still published after having engaged in what should be a crime, the leaking of a CIA covert CIA agent's name, why he still has credibility in the journalistic world is absolutely beyond me.
What was interesting to me is that it's become really clear from looking at some of the evidence that a real large number of White House staff knew Valerie Plame's identity in the days before her identity was leaked. And it's kind of interesting, you know. I mean, you had Cheney, you had Libby, you had Rove, you had Ari Fleischer, the White House press secretary at the time. You had the new guy who took over from Ari Fleischer, who resigned in that same month that all this kind of came out. There's also that timing there to ask, oh, maybe it was Fleischer who leaked your identity because he resigned in that same month. So there's all this other, or maybe it was the new guy not knowing that she was in covert ops and he shouldn't do that. So there's all this other other stuff going on there, too, and this huge number of people on the White House staff who knew about this. It also begs the question of maybe there was somebody even higher up who knew her identity as well and was given the orders or was saying it was okay that we do this smear campaign.
Yeah, and in all the minutia of this case, there are two important facts to keep in mind. Number one, the White House was engaging in a vicious smear campaign against a critic who had not gone public at the time. Wilson actually was the subject of this, and Valerie Plame's name was being passed around the White House a month before Wilson's op-ed appeared in the New York Times. So they were aware of Wilson's criticisms, but it had been inside baseball at the point that this smear campaign started. That's number one. Number two is that it was a campaign of lies that got us into this war in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And that was something that the White House deliberately engaged in. This is what's coming out right now, and this is why people should be outraged.
Moving along, Harriet Myers withdraws this week.
Yeah, she withdrew. Yeah.
Send your resumes in.
That's right. And George Bush is looking for somebody new. Now, I think the interesting thing about all this was she withdrew almost immediately after reporters began looking at the involvement of her law firm in setting up some of these illegal tax shelters and issuing opinions at these illegal tax shelters that the IRS has been going after in the last few years. Her law firm issued opinions that these were perfectly legal. So I think it's interesting that once reporters start to uncover not just, you know, her opinions on abortion, what she may or may not have done for the Bush administration, they start to uncover misdeeds by her law firm while she was the co-managing partner. That's when her nomination gets withdrawn. Of course, the Bush administration, George Bush, wants to blame it on the fact that the Senate wanted to get documents from her time spent as his advisor while he's president. But I think that's really a smokescreen. That didn't stop the Bush administration from pushing through John Roberts. It wouldn't have stopped them from pushing through Harriet Myers, too. I think the real issue here is that Myers' law firm got caught red-handed doing something that they shouldn't have been doing.
Yeah, nobody believes that was the real reason for Myers' mm-hmm. withdrawal. The danger now, of course, is that the Bush administration will try and appease the conservative base of the Republican Party with a new nominee, and that the new nominee is likely to be extremely conservative. That's a real danger. So we may be bracing ourselves for quite a fight on the Supreme Court with the next nomination.
All right. Well, that takes us then to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
Yeah, in election news, we got the final vote tallies finally for the referendum on the Constitution. It was interesting. First, they announced that Anbar province had defeated the Constitution by a 97% no vote. And then they announced that Salahuddin province voted 82% no. And then there was a long, long wait while the Iraqi Electoral Commission counted votes from Nineveh province, which was the key province, to find out whether the Constitution had passed. Again, to review, if three provinces had voted a two-thirds majority no vote, then the Constitution would have been defeated. So finally, on Tuesday, even though the results from Nineveh had been originally announced as a 70% yes vote, on Tuesday, the final total was announced as a 55% no vote, which was an astounding reversal. That was a huge number of no votes that were not counted on the election day and the day after were finally counted. And it kind of begs the question of where did those votes come from and how did they get found by the Iraqi Electoral Commission? There were other problems as well with the vote totals that were announced. In Nineveh, more than 300,000 people voted yes in their final count. They said more than 300,000 people voted yes. However, in the January vote, only about 130,000 had voted for Shiite and Kurdish candidates. So there's a question of, where did that extra 170,000 yes votes come from? Well, some folks say it could have been the minority communities like the Assyrian Christians, Turkmen, etc., who voted for the Constitution in Nineveh. However, it's well known by the U.S. troops who do patrol in Nineveh province that the Assyrian Christian communities, the Turkmen, and other minority groups were arguing that their members should vote no on the Constitution. And on the day of the referendum, on October 15th, most observers in Nineveh province noted that most people exiting the polls had voted no. So that's highly suspicious. Now, I should also point out that the Nineveh polls were guarded and largely controlled by the Kurds, by the Kurdish political groups and the Kurdish Peshmerga. Voter turnout numbers as well in all of the province showed some strange anomalies. In the Shiite South, most provinces had a lower voter turnout than in January, somewhere around 50 to 58%, and most analysts suggested that this reflected a growing disappointment with the majority Shiite government in Baghdad not providing services that people needed, that the Shiite community weren't too happy with them. Now, in the northern Kurdish provinces, there was a huge turnout of somewhere between 75 and 90%, which was to be expected. In the central provinces, which have a mixed population with a higher average Sunnis, but with a large number of minorities in those provinces, there was a very, very high turnout, except in two cases. Now, in Salahuddin province, there was like an 88% turnout. In Tamim, there was a 79 to 80% turnout. In Diyala province, it was 66 or higher. The two exceptions were Nineveh province, which showed a 58% turnout, which seems a little bit low for a province that has a Sunni majority. And in Baghdad, there was a 56% turnout, which also seems very low for a mixed province. So that suggests that there might still be some votes missing out there somewhere from Baghdad province and Nineveh province. And I think it's something that deserves an investigation. However, the current Iraqi Electoral Commission has no incentive to do that, since, of course, they are part of the current Shiite Kurdish government. So,
and the American embassy isn't about to order them to investigate either.
That's right. And the UN has no teeth in Iraq. And in fact, the UN actually have certified the results of the election. Because, of course, what can they do? They can't do anything. They have no power there. In addition, this week, there was a poll that came out, but it's a poll that you're not going to read about in U.S. newspapers. It was a British military commissioned poll of Iraqi citizens' opinions on the occupation. What they found in this poll, commissioned by the British military establishment, is that up to 65% of Iraqis polled supported rebel attacks against U.S. and British troops. 65% of Iraqis support the rebels' attacks against our troops. 45% of Iraqis polled felt that those attacks were justified. So not only did they support the attacks, they felt that they were justified. 82% of Iraqis polled were strongly opposed to the presence of U.S. and British troops in their country. Now, if you're looking at that poll, you might take that as a sign that they want us to leave. Well, you might also recall that the Bush administration, that George Bush said, oh, we'll leave when the Iraqis ask us to. Well, you might say that a poll like that is the Iraqis asking us to leave. You might also look at that poll and see that less than 1% of the respondents thought that U.S. and British troops were responsible for any improvement in security. So there goes the Democrats' main argument that we can't leave Iraq because then the whole security situation would collapse. Well, Iraqis don't think so. In fact, less than 1% of them think so. So, you know, there
what
should
are we doing
be,
there?
So what are we doing there? It's time to leave. And so finally, to wrap up, I just want to mention that adding to the Bush administration's long list of missteps in Iraq, now our National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice are due to meet with Ahmed Chalabi in the coming weeks. Apparently, Ahmed Chalabi has been rehabilitated.
Wasn't he a spy?
He wasn't a spy, but you know what he did do? He's been indicted for money laundering actually convicted of money laundering in Jordan. He's also the guy probably responsible for making up the yellowcake uranium story and providing other false bits of information on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. And he's generally considered not credible, but the Bush administration has forgotten and forgiven, which is another good reason why you shouldn't have fundamentalist Christians in the White House.
Well, it's all okay because I actually saw him as a guest on an Extreme Makeover show. He's a new man. So, talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors of Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
You can find our election endorsements and everything else in Eat the State wherever you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, places like that, and on the web, www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, want to volunteer, have donations, any of that kind of stuff, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.